Amen. Thank you, Brother Matt. All right, Joshua chapter 4 tonight, if you would please. Joshua chapter 4. Joshua chapter 4. Well, all right, as I said this morning, if you were upstairs, I know some of you were downstairs. I'm going to do something a little bit different tonight. We've done this before, but a little bit different for tonight. We've been working on our theme this year of the church, which is his body and members in particular. And we've been talking about what it means to be a member of a church and how to function and operate as a body, how to function, how we ought to operate, get along, deal with each other, all those things, what we're dealing with this year. But we also, of course, came out of our Baptist History Conference, and we've talked about Baptist history in the past. And it's something I kind of feel led to slide in with what we're doing on the church, which is his body. And so we're going to do some Baptist history here and there. We're not going to do like consecutive weeks of it, but I'm going to do one now, then we'll do one on down the road somewhere and just kind of slip it in, kind of break up the other theme a little bit, and also kind of keep some Baptist history before us as well. So this stuff's important, and so we're going to look a little bit of it tonight. We're going to talk about a man tonight that oftentimes isn't covered in a Baptist history conference, and maybe you'll see a little bit why here when we get into a little bit more. But Joshua chapter 4, look in verse 1 if you would. Joshua 4 and verse 1. It says, "And it came to pass, when all the people were clean passed over Jordan, that the Lord spake unto Joshua, saying, Take you 12 men out of the people, out of every tribe a man, and command ye them, saying, Take you hence out of the midst of Jordan, out of the place where the priest's feet stood firm, 12 stones. Ye shall carry them over with you, and leave them in the lodging place where ye shall lodge this night. And then Joshua called the 12 men whom he had prepared of the children of Israel, out of every tribe a man. And Joshua said unto them, Pass over before the ark of the Lord your God into the midst of Jordan, and take up every man of you a stone upon your shoulder, according unto the number of the tribes of the children of Israel, that this may be a sign among you, that when your children ask their fathers in time to come, saying, What mean ye by these stones? Then ye shall answer them that the waters of Jordan were cut off before the ark of the covenant of the Lord, when it passed over Jordan, the waters of Jordan were cut off, and these stones shall be for a memorial unto the children of Israel forever." Let's go ahead and go to the Lord in prayer and ask his help tonight. All right, let's go ahead and pray. Brother Chad, why don't you lead us in prayer? Amen. You can be seated. Thank you for standing. I think we have a precedent for remembering or studying Baptist history. You know, the passage that we just read tonight, Joshua, God instructed Joshua to take up these 12 stones and leave them in the midst of the Jordan River. That was to be done for a memorial, so that when people come by years later, so that when the children and the generations to come came upon these stones, they might say, "What do these mean?" And they would be reminded of God's working in the past. And not only that, is that the case here, but if you've read your Old Testament, you know there were multiple times where God had them erect memorials or things to remember, to record certain things so that they would be remembered in the generations to come. You know the old saying, if you don't know where you came from, you have no idea where you're going or what you're doing. And so it is important to remember where we came from. There's a lot of things that are said of Baptists today that are said because they have no idea where we came from. So it certainly is important that we stay. We have a rich history, completely separate from the Catholic Church, completely separate from Protestants. We have an amazing history, and it's one that we should be familiar with and know about. So it is important that we understand these things. Now, I don't know, am I going to be in the way? Can people see with me standing here? Yes, no? If you can't move, I guess. I don't know what to say. I was going to use that, but it'd be easier if I can stand here, though I may have to keep turning around behind me. First thing I want to do before we get into the guy we're going to talk about tonight, I want to remind us of our Baptist distinctives. And we've been over these many times, but it's good to refresh them, especially so our younger people might be able to remember what they are. Of course, there's 8 Baptist distinctives. B, of course, we use the acrostic Baptist just to help us remember what they are. But B, the Bible is our sole rule of faith and practice. It's the only thing we use for what we believe. We don't have extra books. We don't have an extra book that we turn to, but nothing wrong with books, but the Bible is our sole rule of faith and practice. The autonomy of the local church. We operate completely and independently from all other groups. We're not a part of an organization or a convention or denomination, but rather each church operates and functions independently as we feel led of the Lord to do. That's important, the autonomy of the local church. The priesthood of the believer. I love the doctrine of the priesthood of the believer. I don't need some man to intercede for me. I can intercede for myself directly with God. I don't need someone to... I like to have people pray for me, but I don't need anyone to intercede for me. I don't need to go to some man to receive forgiveness of sins. I can go directly to the Lord Jesus Christ because I'm a priest in my own right through the blood of the Lord Jesus Christ. Two, and only two, ordinances. There are some Baptists. I was just talking about this with somebody the other day. In certain parts of the country, you'll run across some Baptists who practice foot washing. We don't practice that here. If you would like to take it up, more power to you on your own, but we don't practice it here. But we have two and only two ordinances of the Lord's Supper, of course, and baptism. Then individual soul liberty. One of the great tenets of the Baptist faith is individual soul liberty. We are one of the very few throughout history who have held to individual soul liberty, and that is that no one has the right to force anyone to believe in God. Nobody has any right to force anyone to serve God. Nobody has any right to force everyone to be saved or anyone to be saved or to believe what we believe. You know, many people talk about how religion is trying to be forced on people and forced on Americans. We're the last people to force anything on anybody. We'd love to see everybody get saved. We'd love to see everybody serve God because we know what a benefit it would be to them. But under individual soul liberty, we believe you have the right to go to hell if you want to, right? We believe you have the right to be wrong if you want to. I would recommend not doing that, but you have the right to do it nonetheless. Of course, saved and scripturally baptized church membership. We believe in order to be a member of a local church, you must first be saved. And you must first be scripturally baptized to be brought into church membership. There's only two offices, pastor and deacon, according to the scripture. And then S, of course, the other great tenet of the Baptist faith, the separation of church and state. And so these, again, are the Baptist distinctives. And these are the ones that we know of, or we should talk about so often. As the slide says, when we talk about Baptist churches throughout the centuries and throughout history, we're mainly talking about these indicators. These are the indicators we look for. When you look back through 2,000 years of church history, how do you identify a Baptist church? Because we haven't always been known as Baptists. We've been called Donatists and Novationists and many other names. So how do you define one? Well, you look for the indicators. You look for these eight distinctives that we just mentioned. Now, this, of course, these eight distinctives don't exhaust everything we believe. We believe more than eight things, but these are the eight distinctives that identify or are uniquely held by Baptists. And so when we look at Baptist history, we're looking for these eight indicators when we try to identify the church. Now, there may be variants in some churches. If you know, there's not, but even in Baptist churches, we don't always practice the same thing or do the same thing the same way. That's why we're independent Baptists. We can do what we want to do the way we want to do it. And certainly throughout history, you know, we have a bad habit in America today, especially, I guess, maybe among younger people. I don't know. But we have this situation today where we kind of think that our generation, our culture is the way it's always been, the way it always should be. So we're ripping down monuments and tearing down names and canceling people from our past and in our history because they think differently than we think now today. You know, they were a people who were in a time. They lived in a time of their own, and we're dealing with issues in their time. And you can't go back and judge everything everybody said 200 years ago because of the way things are today. You know, and so when you look back through Baptist history, they're not all exactly like we are, these Baptist churches, but they held to these eight distinctives, which is what makes them, as I said, that which we look for in Baptist history. So while there may have been some invariance in less important areas throughout history, a true historic Baptist church will hold to these eight Baptist distinctives that we saw just a moment ago. Now, there are some men, hey, this thing's working pretty well. There are some men who are outliers in Baptist history. They're kind of on the fringe of Baptist history, and you don't hear as much about them. They're men who are important to our Baptist history, but were kind of on the fringe of historic Baptist heritage. These were men who embraced Baptist principles, but because they were off maybe on one of them or they didn't completely understand all eight principles, can't truly be said to be Baptist. But they were, I hate to use the term Baptistic, but they were Baptistic in the sense that they embraced certain Baptist principles and they held some of those. And these were men who embraced Baptist principles And they made important contributions to the Baptist people. And they even made, or especially made, important contributions to early America and to our freedom today as Americans. And so these men, again, who may not be strict Baptists, as we would say, but at the same time, they were men who held to these principles. The guy we're going to look at tonight is Roger Williams. And Roger Williams was one of those men. He is a controversial figure. When you start talking about Baptist history, which is why you don't see him included sometimes in Baptist history conferences. I was trying to remember today. I don't know if anybody in any of the conferences we have talked about Roger Williams, because again, he's kind of controversial. He's controversial because they don't know what to do with him. He's also controversial because of a debate as to whether or not Roger Williams established the first Baptist church in America. And he oftentimes is credited for that. But the reality is, I'll just step out and give you the end, and that is Roger Williams did not establish the First Baptist Church in America. A man by the name of John Clark did, and we'll get to him in another Sunday night somewhere down the road. We'll talk about John Clark and the First Baptist Church in America. But he did establish a church, Roger Williams did, and so because of the way that was carried out, and we'll get to that when we get to the end tonight, when we start talking about him and the church, you know we're almost done. But because of that, he's kind of a controversial figure. Some people don't like to include him in a Baptist history conference. Some do. But I think he plays an important part in our country, and he played an important part even among Baptist people as well, though he was off on a few things in his life. Here we go. Let's get rolling on this. His birth in early years, we've got to find out a little bit about who he is. Williams was believed to have been born around 1599. We don't know exactly the date of his birth, but somewhere around 1599 in London. He lived in a time, of course, when the Church of England ruled everything, the Anglican Church, and their rule was uncontested. And the reason it was uncontested is because their rule was enforced by the power of the king. It was a time when church and state were married together. The church wielded the power of the state to carry out its will. It's hard for us as Americans maybe to fathom that, but that's the way it was. You have to remember, when getting ahead of myself, when Roger Williams came to America, the world had never seen a situation where church and state were separated. And so it was completely foreign to them. You know, America is considered the great experiment. One of the great experiments is, for the first time in history, church and state were separated. And so Williams was born into a situation where that was not yet the case. This was a time when there was no separation of church and state, but as I said, the church enforced its will through the power of the state. He was born into a staunch Anglican family. Is that the right slide? Yeah, he was born into a staunch Anglican family. He attended the famous St. Sepulchre Church, which I'm sure you've all heard of, but it would be famous if you were in England. It was established in 1066, I think it is, isn't it? And so it had been around for quite some time. He attended that. Williams wrote that as early as 12 years of age, he'd already began to see the problems with the Anglican Church. 12-year-olds, you know, back then, people were going to Cambridge at 14, you know, so they had a pretty good understanding of things back then. So at 12, he's already beginning to see problems within the Anglican Church, and especially in relationship to the persecution of nonconformists. Williams wrote fairly extensively about the fact that he felt he was persecuted even in his own home, because his father was a staunch Anglican, and he made life a little difficult for Williams even when he was a child. His early life, his intellect — he was an extremely brilliant guy, as many of these men were. His intellect and his skill came to the attention of a man by the name of Sir Edward Coke. Coke was one of the most famous attorneys of that day, and he was famous for a couple of different trials, considered a brilliant lawyer. Sir Edward Coke was the man who prosecuted Sir Walter Raleigh. I don't know about you about English history, but Sir Walter Raleigh was big or important during the time of Queen Elizabeth I. He kind of fell out of favor near the end of that. And in the succeeding kings, he fell out of even more favor. He was tried and jailed several times, finally tried and executed for various things, which we don't care about tonight. But Coke was involved in his prosecution, which was a high-level prosecution. And then on top of that, many of you, or some of you, if you've studied much history, may have heard of the Gunpowder Plot, where there was a plot to blow up Parliament, I think it was, wasn't it? They were going to blow up. And Sir Walter Coke was involved in the prosecution of those who were going to blow up Parliament, if that was what they were going to blow up. Coke met Roger Williams, and when he met Roger Williams, he saw the potential in this young man. He was a young teen at this point, and he was responsible for getting Roger Williams into a very prestigious school. We might call it a prep school now in our time, but was very involved in getting him in that. Williams went on from that to receive a scholarship to Cambridge. He studied language and theology and the classics. So extremely well educated, very smart guy. This is what they say he looked like. Sir Edward Coke. Fellows, don't, if you ever complain about having to wear a tie, just be glad you don't have to dress that way, all right? But that's what they say, a drawing of Sir Edward Coke. Now, Williams eventually became Coke's office manager, and this is important for this reason, and it's as a result of him becoming Coke's office manager that he began to move in the circles that Coke did. He began to meet a lot of the men that Sir Edward Coke knew, and the reason that's important is because Sir Edward Coke was a very independent thinking guy. And the people he ran with were independent thinkers. They were intelligent people who opposed King Charles I because his rule was tyrannical, an absolute monarch. And they also rejected the idea of the church's intolerance and the fact that the church was enforcing its will through the state. And so Williams begins to meet these people, and he's running in these circles, and he begins they begin to influence his thinking. I think this is a great example of the providence of God, don't you? It's amazing sometimes when you look back in your life. I've said this before. You don't notice it at the time. But later on in years, when you look back on your life and you see how God brought people into your life or God put you in certain places in your life, and you can look back and see the influence of them and how they've influenced you and how God used them in your life. I'm sure if you were to ask Roger Williams at this point when he was hanging out with these independent thinking men, if these men were going to somehow shape his future, he probably wouldn't have thought that. But again, it's a providence of God. Aren't you glad God moves and works not just in nations but in people's lives as well? And God can sometimes work through people to influence nations, as he does with Roger Williams. And so he begins to meet these people, and they begin to influence his thinking. This is where the flames of Williams' nonconformist views were fanned. These were separatists who were not seeking to reform the Church of England, but they wanted the right to worship and have a church of their own, completely independent from the control and influence of the Anglican Church. Now, in the meantime, while Coke and his circle is influencing Roger Williams, and Roger Williams' conformist views and were being fanned as rebellious views, as the Church of England would see it, but his nonconformist views were being fanned. During the same time, there was tremendous persecution of separatists taking place in England and nonconformists. And they were pretty much reaching a fever pitch. It was getting very difficult to be a nonconformist. Nonconformist, again, being the idea that you're not going to submit to this whole concept of church and state. And as a result of that, there was tremendous persecution taking place. And one example of that was a Puritan leader by the name of Dr. Layton. I think I've got his slide up here. He was arrested. This is the correct slide. Yep. He was arrested. Layton was arrested by Archbishop Laud. And the following sentence was passed upon him, that he be committed to the prison of the Fleet for life. That's where they put you out on a ship in the middle of the ocean for life. And pay a fine of 10,000 pounds. Now, I don't know how much 10,000 pounds was back then, but I would think it would be an impossible figure based on what a pound is worth today. That the High Commission should degrade him from his ministry, that he should be brought to the pillory at Westminster. If you're not familiar with a pillory, you know what it is. It's where they put your hands and head in the stock. And then they whip you, that's a pillory. And while the court was sitting, and be publicly whipped, after whipping to be set upon the pillory a convenient time, and have one of his ears cut off, one side of his nose split, and he be branded in the face with a double SS for sower of sedition, that then he should be carried back to prison, and after a few days be pilloried a second time in Cheapside, and have the other side of his nose split and his other ear cut off, and then be shut up in close prison for the rest of his life. Now, this was for nothing more. This wasn't for murder. This wasn't for rape. This wasn't for some other thing. This was simply for saying, I don't recognize the authority of the church and the state to rule over men's lives. And, of course, this was what they considered nonconformists. It's hard for us to fathom, isn't it? You know, that this type of punishment could be meted out by the church as it controls the state. And whenever those two combine, it's an ugly situation. And so Williams' desire for liberty is being fanned. His nonconformist views are being fanned. At the same time, things like this are taking place in England, which is, of course, certainly just igniting that flame even more in his hunger to see freedom. Now, real quick, before we go any farther, let's talk real quick about the difference between Puritans and separatists, because Williams is involved with two groups of people or circling around two groups of people. They're the Puritans. I think we've probably all heard of Puritans. May not know what they are, but we've heard of them. There's Puritans and Separatists. Now, there's similarities between the two. Those similarities are this. Both were considered nonconformists, both the Puritans and the Separatists, because they were both nonconforming to this idea of church and state. And so they were considered rebels against the authority of the church and her magistrate. Nonconformist means that they were both unwilling to conform to the rule of the established church. But they were considered, but both considered the Anglican church to be corrupt, as well as her clergy. So then in that they agreed, the Separatists and the Puritans. But there were some differences between the two. There was one major difference, which would turn out to be an extremely important difference. While the Separatists and the Puritans, they both recognized how corrupt the Church of England was and the need for change, they greatly differed in how to go about that. And the difference was this. The Puritans wanted to reform the church within. They didn't want to leave the Anglican church. They didn't want to leave the Church of England. They wanted to reform it from within, kind of like Protestantism, you know, in the early days when they sought to reform the Catholic Church. The Puritans sought to reform the church from within. They wanted to maintain fellowship and communion with the Mother Church of England. They had no desire to separate or to break from the old church, but again, to change it or conform it. The Separatists, on the other hand, believed that the Church of England was apostate, that it was beyond recovery, and they desired to establish a new church, to establish separate congregations, to separate completely from the authority of the established church. And this is important. You all still with me? This is important because this is going to set the Puritans and the Separatists on a collision course. A collision course that's going to be deadly for a lot of the Separatists as this plays out. This difference between how to handle this. The Separatists say, no, the church is so corrupt, we just need to scrap it and establish new, independent, free congregations. While the Puritans thought, no, we can conform the church and or reform the church and stay within it. So this is going to be a huge issue as we go forward in this. Now, as it says, this issue, the issues the Separatists faced and fought in the old world would follow them to the new world. So we've got Puritans and Separatists in England. They're eventually going to come to the new world, as we're going to see. And when they come to the new world, the Separatists are going to find out that the old world problems are going to follow them here. The Puritans, who had petitioned for tolerance concerning their own faith in the old world, would refuse the same consideration for others in the new world. And as a result of that, the Puritans would become the persecutors. So when the Separatists and the Puritans get here, the Puritans establish the church, they get into power, and even though they petitioned for freedom for their faith in England, when they get here, they refuse that freedom for others. And of course, the Separatists and Puritans are then going to be on a head-on collision course because of all that's about to take place. Everybody still with me? Okay, we're just trying to understand Roger Williams' time. Where's the right button at here? Did I go back twice? I think I did. No, I didn't. During this time, yep, we're in a good spot. During this time, two Separatist churches were established in England. So we got these Separatists in England. They're the ones who say, no thank you. The Church of England is so corrupt, we can't do anything with it. And so they set about establishing two churches in England. Of course, that was a dangerous proposition, but they were able to do it. Eventually, both of them eventually migrated out of England, and they eventually migrated to Holland, where they would establish churches in Holland because it was more free in the area of Holland. One of those churches eventually dissolved, and the people returned back to England. The other was known as the Scrooby Congregation. I don't know where that name comes from, S-C-R-O-O-B-Y, Scrooby. I might have come up with a different name, but it was called the Scrooby Congregation. They eventually migrated to Holland as well. But they got to Holland and found it wasn't as free as they wanted, so they wanted more freedom. So about 100 of them left Holland and set sail in 1620 on a ship you may recognize. It was called the Mayflower. And this group, of course, were known as the Pilgrims. And they, of course, were Puritans as well, or held to strong Puritan sentiments. And so there was a movement of Separatists taking place about this time. Now, this brings us to William's idea about liberty, because he's watching all. You got to remember, he's a man of his time, so he's already got this desire for liberty. I think people naturally desire liberty, don't you? I don't understand what's going on in our country where people beg for government control. I don't know about you, but I'd rather be free. I want liberty. I'd rather have liberty than to be taken care of. You know, I would rather be in danger and be free than to think I'm safe and be ruled by the government. All right? because I believe we need liberty and we desire liberty. Well, Williams did as well. And so he began to get these ideas of liberty. Now, about this time, about this time, and because of the nonconformist views that he'd been exposed to, Williams began to be burdened for the idea of freedom of conscience and freedom of religion. It began to be a burden on him. I think God was working on his heart, don't you? Began to be a burden for that. And he began to write in these personal letters about a call to New England. He began to feel that God was calling him to New England. Now, eventually, when he gets to New England, he'll begin to focus that call more on the Native Americans, more on the Indians. And he had a great burden for the souls of the Indian people. And he would spend most of his successful time in ministry among them. But he began to write about this call to New England. So in December of 1630, he and Mary, who was his wife, we're not going to get into all where she came from, but they were married for about 40 years until the time of her death. They boarded a ship and sailed for the New World. And they arrived here after 66 days. I can't fathom 66 days on one of those old, creaking, rotten sailing ships, but 66 days to get here. I complain, listen, I'm at the point in my life where 7 hours is a long car ride, so I can't imagine spending 66 days. But they did, and they arrived here on February 5th of 1631, and so they get to the New World. The Puritans in Boston, the Puritans are well established now in New England. They're well established in Boston, in the New England area, and they're excited that Roger Williams is coming, because Roger Williams knows Sir Edward Coke. He's pretty well connected with a lot of the Puritans back in England. And so they think this is a smart guy, very well connected guy. They were excited that Edwards was coming, and they were excited all the way up until the time he got off the boat. Because once they got off the boat, they figured out that he had a firebrand of a nonconformist on their hands, that he wasn't going to fall in line with the Puritans. He was going to become a huge thorn in their side. So it didn't take long for the honeymoon to end once Roger Williams landed here. 5 years, as a matter of fact, he got here in 1631. Just 5 years later, in 1636, the very same Puritans that were excited about him coming tried to get him banished back to England. They wanted him out of the country and all the way back. They didn't want him out of town. They wanted him all the way back in England. And so just 5 years later, they sought to put him out. And it was here that he also began to develop a burden for the souls of the Native Americans. He began to see their plight, and he was concerned about it. To my knowledge, and if I'm wrong, you can correct me, but to my knowledge, he's the first missionary to the Native people. There was a man who came, whose name I can't remember, who came shortly after him, but I believe Roger Williams predated him. First, what we might consider a real missionary to the Native people was Roger Williams, and he had a tremendous friendship with them. As a matter of fact, what made Roger Williams so important in many ways was he was the first to espouse the idea that they were, that the Native American Indians were to be equal in respect, equal in treatment, equal in rights, and they were to be equal under the law, which, as you can imagine, was a foreign concept at the time. But when Roger Williams got here, he had this burden for them, and he felt, you know what, they're people like we are. They have the same rights. They have the same rights under the law. They should be treated equally with everyone else. So he was the first to espouse that in New England. This burden, his treatment of the Native Americans and his friendship with them would play a large part in saving the lives of many of those people in New England. I don't remember how much of this is on the slides. Not much of it. He had a great burden for these Native Americans, and that friendship that he developed with them, he also learned the language. He was one of the few that learned the Native American language so that he could deal with them and witness to them. He had a great, as I said, a burden for their souls. And that was going to play a large part in saving the lives of the very people who banished him. Because in 1636, when they sought to banish him, at the same time they banished him, they turned around and said, "Would you please go talk to the Indians so they won't kill us?" And they tried to work out a treaty with them. And Williams did that. It's kind of amazing that, and we'll get to that in a little bit, Williams actually did that while he was banished by the very people who were wanting him to go intervene for them. But Williams, again, probably a bigger man than maybe I would have been. And so he goes and does that. But he was able to save, through that friendship with the Indians, many lives in New England. Now, Williams believed that the New World represented a once-in-history opportunity. Now, you got, as Americans, it's hard for us, because we were born into this, right? We were free-born. And so we've been born into this, and it's hard to conceive for us of a time when things were not like they are now, where state and church ruled everything, where there was no freedom of conscience, there was no liberty of conscience, that if you didn't fall in line with the church, then you were beaten or killed or your property seized. It's hard for us to imagine a time like that. But Williams saw a once in a history opportunity to establish freedom of worship and freedom of conscience for every man. included the Native Americans. And this was an understanding of liberty that at this time only a handful of people had. It's one of the things that's really hard for me to conceive is how there was no thought of liberty, of how few people had any thought of, I guess you just conform. And so there was so little thought of liberty. You would think people would be going, man, we need a free church. You know, we need to be worshiping freedom. We need to be able to have freedom of conscience. But Roger Williams, as our founders later on, about 100 years or so later, they were very few who had real concept of freedom of conscience and liberty of conscience. I don't know why that's hard for me to believe, because we seem to be flowing in the other direction. Now where we're losing that, we're going back to people who'd rather be ruled than be free. But he was one of a handful of people at the time. According to Newman, historian Newman, he said this: Roger Williams advocated the complete separation of church and state at a time when there was no historical example of such separation. He had this idea of a separation of church and state when nowhere in history had separation of church and state been seen, because up until this time, that's all they knew. And Roger Williams had this burden for that. Look over to Matthew 22, if you would. And some of this you already know, so we're not going to spend a huge amount of time on it, but Matthew chapter 22, you'll recognize this passage immediately. But the Bible's clear that there is to be separation of church and state, separation between civil government and God, and civil government and the local church. Matthew chapter 22, look if you would in verse 21, very simple passage you'll recognize. And they say unto him, Caesar's. Then saith he unto them, render therefore unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and unto God the things that are God's. And he establishes, in many other verses we could look at, this idea of separation of church and state. There is God's realm and there is civil government's realm. There's the church's realm and civil government's realm. And those two are never, of course, to come together. Now, that doesn't mean that government and church cannot work together. Doesn't mean that at all. Doesn't mean that we can't work together on some level. It doesn't mean that government can't support church community work, church daycares. Doesn't mean the government can't do that. I don't understand for the life of me why any church would want to get tangled up with the government over money. But there's no reason why they can't do that if they don't want to. It doesn't mean that churches can't have political positions. Doesn't mean we can't be involved in elections. We're not going to have some politician for office come here and speak. But if we wanted to, we could. There's no reason constitutionally why we couldn't. I don't care about our tax exempt status. They can have it if they want it. We're going to preach what we want and do what we want. But there's no reason why we couldn't do that if we wanted to. What it simply means is that neither the church nor the government are to veer into the other's lane, into the God-given lane of responsibility that each have. Government has a plan, or has a lane under God's plan, and so does the church. And we're not to veer into each other's lane. You know, when government veers into the lane of the church's responsibility, the church is under no obligation to obey government in that area. Amen? It's the reason why Acts chapter 5 talks, I think it's Acts 5, 28, 29 or so, is where it says we must obey God rather than man. Now, I would just soon go along with the government, wouldn't you? I'm not a rebel. I don't think we should build a compound somewhere and all hide out. I'm not for that. I'd just soon obey and get along as best we can. But if there comes a point where we have to choose between government and God, our obedience, our loyalty, of course, belongs to the Lord, and we should side with Him. And I'm afraid we're headed for a showdown today in our country, aren't you? I think we're headed for a showdown. Most churches are too busy with issues and infighting and everything else that's going on rather than realizing there's a problem much bigger than our neighbor. And that is that we're headed for a time, I think, we've never been tested in the past about where we're going to stand and the stand we're going to take. If you don't think this issue of homosexuality and gender, if you don't think they're going to eventually get around to our free speech, then I don't know where you've been, because they're already dealing with churches that take any money, any form of government money, which is why church should never take a form of government money. Government never gave anybody anything. And so they've already got around to that. Certain states are already trying to pass laws to regulate speech, even in the pulpit, considering any preaching against homosexuality is hate speech. So it's coming. It's coming. It's not a time to be apathetic. It's not a time to be focused on each other. It's time to be focused on what we're doing and serving the Lord. And when it comes to government, there can be mutual support, but there can never be interference with each other. Now, here's the problem. The problem was this, and that is, for the most part, this is a quote from Roger Williams' biography, for the most part, the founders of these colonies came to this country imbued with the same ideas concerning the relations between government and religion, which had been universal in Europe. So in other words, when they came here, they brought the same old thinking that the church and state are to be united. That's the reason we said very few people had any understanding that that's not what God says. It should be separate and distinct. But when they got here, I guess you're the product of your upbringing, aren't you? And so this is what they were experienced. This is what they knew. This is what they've been taught. And so when they came here, they didn't get rid of that. It's kind of like we talk about all the time. You hear about people moving out of California, you know, the mess they've made out of California, and they're moving to different various states. And I'm sure many of you may have thought the same thing I've thought. Well, that would be great as long as they leave what got them in trouble in California in California. All right. But I fear that they're bringing that with them. Well, when they came from the new world, old world to the new world, they brought the same old thinking. All right. So that brings us to the new old world. Because it was a new world, but it was still old thinking. And when Williams arrived in the new world, the hypocrisy of the Puritans infuriated him. Because when he got here, he found that they had established the Congregational Church, and Boston and much of England was governed by what they referred to as the Black Hats. It was kind of a slang term. The Black Hats was a court of 25 to 30 Puritans, chosen, of course, from the Congregational Church leadership. And their job was to establish, make, interpret, and enforce laws, especially congregational church law. So if you got in trouble over anything, you appeared before a church court, before the Black Hats, this court of congregational leadership. So he gets there and he finds this taking place and this going on. As I said, Williams was infuriated that the Puritans, who had demanded tolerance in old England for their faith, now denied all others the same tolerance in the New World. The Puritans had become a separate church from the Church of England, but they had established the same thing in New England that they'd fled in Old England. The courts of New England were church courts, which was heading for disaster when it came to the pure separatists. Can you imagine being a pure separatist having to be tried in a church court under the Puritans? Now, the men who had been philosophically in agreement, I don't think that's on there, but before Williams left England, there was a group of men, there were a lot of men who philosophically were in agreement with Williams that, yeah, we need a separate church. We need a separate and distinct church. Some of the Puritans held that view. But what he found is that when he got to the New World, some of those who were philosophically in agreement with him in the Old World now became his enemy in the New World. One of those was John Winthrop, who was the governor of Massachusetts Bay Colony when Williams arrived. And he was an ally of Williams when he was in England. However, once in New England, he wrote of Williams' views of separation church and state. He said, "He hath broached new and dangerous opinions against the authority of the magistrates." It's amazing, isn't it, how you have one view, and then when you get in power, you have another view. And so he very soon began to realize he didn't have much in the way of allies. Williams had come to New England believing he was going to be working with freedom-seeking men, and he found out he was working with men who brought old England with them once he got here. Now, Williams attempted to preach in Boston, Salem, and Plymouth. There's a lot more detail to this, how he gets from one place to another and when he gets from one place to another. But he eventually tries to preach in Boston, Salem, and Plymouth, but only found the same old England mentality. And he withdrew from all three of those. And he said, "I conscientiously refused and withdrew from Plymouth because I durst not officiate with an unseparated people." And when he talks about unseparated, he's not talking about sin or separation like we use the word. He's talking about separated from this concept of church and state. He said, "I refuse to deal with a group of people who will not come out from under the Congregational Church or the Church of England." And so he refused to do that. Now what happens is, there's four things in particular that begin to really push now Roger Williams. He's already got this nonconformist view being fanned in his life. And four laws are passed when he arrives that really gets things rolling in his life. The first of those laws that were passed was the oath of a freeman. Now, the oath of a freeman sounds maybe like a good thing, but in 1635, the Boston court passed a law requiring all men 16 years of age or older to take this oath of a freeman. As I said, it sounded good on the surface because you declared your freedom from the Church of England. That wouldn't be bad. I'd take that oath. All right. So that sounds good on the surface. But the problem is that the same oath required allegiance to the Congregational Church. So you promised separation from one and placed yourself in bondage to another. So he had to swear an oath to the Congregational Church, including all its laws. And here's the thing that got William's goat and a lot of the separatist goat, because you also had to pledge to baptize your infants into the Congregational Church. Now, how you declare this the oath of a free man, I have no idea. But you had to swear to do this and take the oath to do this. And of course, this married once again the church and what? Married again the church and the state. And it remained that way in Massachusetts. Massachusetts was one of the worst places. It remained that way in Massachusetts for the next 160 years, all the way up through the Revolutionary War, this church and state relationship remained. And as a result, because of this oath of a freeman and the refusal to take it or adhere to it, as a result of that, people had their homes and their property burnt or confiscated. Men and women were banished, as well as beatings, imprisonments, whippings, and even hangings took place because men refused to take this oath of a freeman. Now, we look back on that and think, this is horrible. How terrible that is that people would turn on one another. I'll remind you a little bit about COVID, all right, and mass and vaccinations and how quickly people will turn on each other over the littlest of things. I mean, it was almost you had to take the oath of the COVID mask or you were going to be in trouble. And so it's not hard to conceive of how people might turn on one another. And that was what took place here. On April 30th, 1635, Williams was brought before the Boston court for preaching against the oath of a freeman and refusing to retract what he had said and refusing to retract what he had said. They told him to retract. This is early Twitter banning, all right, for you younger people, all right? That is, they won't delete it for you. You have to delete it so that you admit that what you put on there was wrong. And that's the same thing took here. You had to admit that what you said was wrong. And Roger Williams said, no, I said it. I meant it. I'm not retracting it. I'm not deleting my tweet. All right. And so because of that, he got drugged before the court and for refusing to retract it. And this would lead, and I'll get to this in a minute, this would lead to the court giving the land for preacher alternative to the church at Salem. And I'll explain what that means here in just a moment. Now, the court ruling was this. The court ruling read this way in September 3rd, 1635. It says, whereas Roger Williams, one of the elders of the Church of Salem, hath broached and divulged divers new and dangerous opinions against the authority of the magistrates and the church, as also with other defamation, both of the magistrates and churches here, and that before any conviction, and yet maintaineth the same without retraction, it is therefore ordered that said Mr. Williams shall depart out of this jurisdiction within 6 weeks, now next ensuing, which if he neglect to perform, it shall be lawful for the governor and two magistrates to send him to some place out of this jurisdiction, not to return any more without license from this court. And so they banished him, is what they did. I don't know. I think I would have left willingly, but they banished him. The second law that got Williams moving was the law of patents. The law of patents. Now, what the law of patents said was this has nothing to do with what patent like we might think of, but Williams was one, if not the first settler, to speak out and preach against this law. And this law declared, the law of patents declared, that if a Christian king could lay hold on anything that was discovered by so-called Christian explorers. So if a quote Christian king sent out a quote Christian explorer and he found something, the king could lay hold on it by virtue of his Christianity. And this law was being used in the New World to confiscate the land of the Indians, because King Charles sent them over here, so anything they discovered was his, and they were able to just confiscate it from the Indians. And Williams, of course, vehemently opposed the seizing of native lands, was a vehemently in opposition of opposing native lands. Williams' position on the duty of governors to govern was light years ahead of anybody during his time. And again, this is hard for us to conceive of, that here's a man who believes that church and state should be separate and who believes that governors have a responsibility to the governed. And this whole concept was light years ahead of his time. They were certainly Baptist principles. He staunchly preached against the notion that Christian kings, by virtue of their Christianity, had the right to take and give away the lands and property of others, including the native people. He preached that the land of the native people could only be obtained by mutual agreement and compensation. In other words, the Indians had to agree to sell it and you had to pay for it. And so that's the only way that he believed that it should be done. When it comes to biblical government, you know, one thing the Bible's clear on is the right to property. I preached a whole series on biblical government some time ago, and we talked about the right to property. One of the fundamental rights, even more important than freedom of speech, is the right to own property. As I've said before, if you don't have anywhere to stand, you can't speak. All right, so you have to have the right to own your own property. And the Bible makes that clear. Jeremiah, look over in Jeremiah 18. I'll just give you one or two verses. I don't want to get off on this, so we can get this wrapped up here. Jeremiah chapter 18, and again, I think you can still get access to those messages on church government. We talked about this at length. God used an illustration of the potter and the clay in Jeremiah 18, where he says, "The word which came to Jeremiah from the Lord, saying, Arise and go down to the potter's house, and there I'll cause thee to hear my words. And then went I down to the potter's house, and behold, he wrought a work on the wheels, and the vessel that he made of clay was marred in the hand of the potter. So he made it again another vessel, as seemed good to the potter to make it. Then the word of the Lord came unto me, saying, O house of Israel, can I not do with you as this potter? Saith the Lord, behold, the clay is in the potter's hand, so ye are mine, O house of Israel." And God talks about the fact, I can do with you. Listen, we're saved. If you're saved tonight, we're his people. God can do with us as he wills, because we are his property. We've been purchased with the precious blood of the Lord Jesus Christ. We've been bought with the price. You know what the Bible says? We've been redeemed. And so he owns us, and he has the right to do what he wills with us. And he repeats that same idea in Isaiah 64 and again in Isaiah 45, where he talks about the fact that He is our potter, and we are the clay. He has the right to do with that which is his. Of course, one of the best verses on that is in Matthew chapter 20, where Jesus gets into this discussion with these two men that he hired to work in the field. Remember that discussion? The one man, he paid both men the same amount, though one started early in the morning and the other started early in the evening. The evening guy was a union man, so he said, hey, it's not right that that guy's making more money than I am. And so Jesus said, hey, I'm paying you what I said I would pay you. And is it not right for me to do with mine what I want? It's not your business to tell me what to do with my money. You said you'd work for a penny. You work for a penny. I've paid you a penny. I have not wronged you. Right. Because it's mine. I can do with it as I will, and I can give it. If I want to pay him $5 and you $1, that's my right to do. It's my money. I can do what I want to with it. And so the Bible certainly supports this idea of property rights. No government. This is going to sound rebellious, but no government, president, king, or Congress has the right to seize anyone's property without consent, without the consent of the government. And that includes wages, which is property. Your wages are your property. And so we should have representation when it comes to those things. We don't have the right, the government does have the right just to lay hold on individuals' property or their wages. I've given this illustration before, you know, and that is that government, and this is such an outdated view, but government has no right to do what you don't have the right to do when it comes to property. And I've given this example before. Let me give it again just real quick because I enjoy giving it. So I'm going to give it again real quick. Let's say Brother Tim here has five cars. We're a neighborhood. We're all a neighborhood. Brother Tim here has five cars. Brother Humble here doesn't have one, and he needs one. And so I'm sitting in my house one day, and I look and see all these cars sitting in Brother Tim's lot. He has five. He only drives one. He's not even driving the other four. He doesn't need five cars. Who needs five cars? Nobody needs five cars. All right? And so I go over to Brother Tim's house, and I knock on his door and say, hey, I see you got five cars. You're only driving four. And in my opinion, you don't need five cars because you're only driving one. So you should give one of your cars to Brother Humble because he doesn't have a car. And he needs a car. So Brother Tim, if he's smart, says this, get off my porch. Who do you think you are? You don't have any right to tell me what to do with my cars. If I want to own 15 cars, I will. Nobody has a right to tell me in America how many cars. I'll own a car lot if I want to. It's none of your business. Get off my porch. That's what I would say. I don't know what Brother Tim would say. That's what I would say. So what I do is I go call all you together and we have a big meeting, neighborhood meeting. And I tell you, it's not right. This isn't right. No one should be so wealthy as to have five cars when poor Brother Humble doesn't have a single car. So we all get together and vote that Brother Tim should give up his cars and give some of those to Brother Humble. Now, we don't have the right as a group to do what I didn't have the right to do as an individual. Does that make sense? Amen. Just because we've all ganged up now doesn't mean we have any more right to take Brother Tim's cars. It's his property. Amen. If he wants to watch Brother Humble walk to work every day just for meanness, he can do it if he wants to, all right? And if he wants to give him a car, he can of his own free will. And that's this whole idea of personal property. And so Williams was extremely angry. He was 100 years ahead of his time when it came to personal property rights and the restraint of government. Now, all of this earned him, all of this idea of freedom and property rights earning a rebuke from the famous Puritan leader, John Cotton. You may not know much about him, but you may have heard of John Cotton if you had much early American history. Historian David Bennett, speaking of Williams, wrote this: Williams was most thoroughly convinced that the untutored savages were lords of the soil on which the God of nature had planted them, and therefore took the utmost care that none of the inhabitants of this infant colony should occupy the least part of it until it was fairly purchased from the aboriginal proprietors. Fancy way of saying nobody should move on to anything unless they bought it from the Indians, because it's their property. Interestingly enough, this is one of the great things that won Williams the heart of the Indians, because he opposed the seizing of their property and the purchasing of property. This also gave him a great opportunity to witness to these people, because it was very evident that he cared about them and he cared for their soul. And so it went a long way toward allowing him to deal with them, which in turn then, remember we talked about earlier in 1636, the very same people who banished him said, "Would you please go and try to keep the Indians from killing all of us?" Well, the reason Williams was able to do that was because he opposed the seizing of Indian land. And so all this came together to help the very people who were seizing land and trying to banish Roger Williams at the same time. Williams, 5 years after being banished by the Puritans, as I said, was asked to negotiate with the Indians in an effort to bring some form of peace. And this he did, and he was able to bring a form of peace for a time, and of course saved many of the Puritans. He undertook a 75-mile upriver journey in the middle of winter in order to be able to do it. And Williams, of course, because he had the ear of the natives and they had great respect for him, and he had great respect for their culture and their language, and he loved their soul, he was able to broker a peace deal that saved him for a time. It would later fall apart, but he was able to broker some type of deal while he was there. And this all happened in 1636 when he'd been banished, and to our knowledge, he never returned once again to the rest of New England. He remained in banished territory after this was all over. Isaac Backus, the historian, wrote, "And what would the English have done if they had sent Williams out of the country as they had intended? They'd all been dead had they succeeded in banishing Williams." Williams later wrote, here's the type of man Williams was. He later on wrote in his life that he was thankful and grateful to God that God had allowed him to be a blessing to those who had cursed him. He wrote in his biography, he was thankful that God had allowed him to save their life. Got to move on here. The Puritans saw themselves as not simply as settlers of a new land, but founders of a new Israel, a Christian theocracy in the new land. And Williams' response to these laws so incensed the Puritans and the congregational leaders that they weren't content to banish him from the city or the colony, that even when he fled into the wilderness, they pursued him in an effort to have him banished from the continent. Backus, the historian, wrote this. He said, What human heart can be unaffected with the thought that a people who had been sorely persecuted in their own country, so as to flee 3,000 miles into the wilderness for religious liberty, yet should have the same imposing temper cleaving so fast to them as to be willing to let a godly minister who testified against it stay even in any neighboring part of their wilderness, but move them to attempt to take him by force and send him back to the land of their persecutors? He says, how crazy can it be that you flee for religious freedom, then you get here, and a guy who wants religious freedom, you're going to send him back to the land of the persecutors? Again, it makes no sense whatsoever. The third law that got him going, I'm going to fly on here. The third law that got him going was the enforcement of the first table of the law. And this is a gross interpretation of Matthew chapter 14, verse 23, where it says, go out into the hedges and byways and compel them to come in. And it's this idea that government or the church should enforce the first table of the law, the first of the five commandments. This law, which was practiced by the Congregationalists in New England, but would be practiced by state-controlled churches everywhere. As a matter of fact, our Baptist forefathers would die by the thousands because of this idea of the enforcement of the first table of the law. It would be used against us in many ways. The first table of the law, the first five commandments, are man's duty to God. And the Congregationalists believed that it was their responsibility to enforce man's duty to God in all of their colonies and over everyone within their colony. Perceived violations of the first table of the law were punishable by imprisonment, confiscation, beating and death, refusal to observe the Sabbath, holding unauthorized church services, and failure to baptize your infants was particularly egregious under that law. Baptists particularly ran afoul of this because of baptism. It was considered extremely blasphemous not to baptize your infant, especially blasphemous was also rebaptism of anyone. The enforcement of the first table was used by Augustine. We've heard of him, haven't we? Augustine. It was used by Augustine against the Donatists, who are in our Baptist lineage. Used the magistrates to slaughter them. Pope Innocent III against the Waldensians and Albigenses, also our Baptist heritage. John Calvin used it against the Baptist. I wouldn't give a nickel for a John Calvin commentary just because of that. He was not a friend of the Baptist. He was an enemy of the Baptist people. Zwingli, the Swiss reformer, used it to persecute and drown the Anabaptists. Zwingli was involved in chaining people together and shoving off a bridge because they refused to baptize their infants. His position was, if you want to be dunked, I'll dunk you. And he drowned many Anabaptists in Switzerland. Countless others died. Williams thundered against it from the pulpit, preaching that no person should be punished in any way if they choose not to serve God or choose not to obey him. God is clear on the great doctrine of freedom of choice, isn't he? Joshua 24, you may have it hanging on your refrigerator, your wall somewhere. Joshua 24, 15 is where Joshua says, choose you this day. You know, Jesus Christ, he doesn't say, get over here. He says, come to me by way of invitation. And so we're to come and serve him by freedom of choice. And then the fourth law that got William's goat, I guess, for the lack of a better term, was the land for preacher deal. Now, the way this worked was this. Williams was pastoring in Salem, Massachusetts at the time. And the Boston court had called for his removal from the pulpit. So the Boston court ordered the church at Salem to fire the preacher. However, the church at Salem said, no, I don't think so. We're not going to fire our preacher. And so what happens was Salem, the Salem area, included, they say, the much coveted Marble Neck Beach and waterfront area. And so the court called the entire town together in a meeting and told them, here's what's going to happen. You either get rid of the preacher, you get rid of Williams, or we're going to confiscate the Marble Neck area. So they got rid of the preacher. All right. And again, this was in Salem, Massachusetts. And so he faced this as well. Don't go and get between people and money. All right. As a result, where am I here? Am I got the right spot? Nope, I went too far, I think. Let me back up one. There you go. Williams' expulsion due to the land for preacher deal in 1636 was followed. I find this interesting. I can't prove it. But it was followed in 1636 by the Salem witch trials. Salem, to this day, is known for what? It's closely associated with witchcraft and everything that is demonic. Now, I can't prove that it's connected to this, but it is interesting, don't you think, the timing and the date that that was the case. Psalm 105:15 says, touch not mine anointed and do my prophet no harm. There's two things you've got to be careful messing with. That's God's man and God's house, right, with those two things, because it can get you in trouble in a hurry, and they certainly found that out. Now, as a result of Williams' preaching, now we're here where we're supposed to be. As a result of Williams preaching, especially opposing the four things we just saw, he was ordered. Yeah, he saw. My mind says four things he just saw. He was ordered by the court in September of 1636 to report for banishment back to England. Imagine their surprise when he missed his appointment, all right? They said, you're to report back here so we can send you back to England. And Williams said, no, thank you. I don't think so. He earlier on wrote this. Williams wrote, God knows what gains and preferments I have refused in university, city, country, court in old England, and something in New England, to keep my soul undefiled in this point and not to act with a doubting conscience. He said, I've given up much and sacrificed much in order to stand for religious liberty and for religious freedom. So he refused to show up. As a result of all this, and now convinced that he couldn't preach or see his dream of religious liberty established in the existing colonies, he and a few sympathizers, some around 15, 18, something like that, fled into the wilderness. This was all part of when he went to try to negotiate for these colonists. 15 or so people went with him into the wilderness. And Williams used his relationship with the natives to negotiate and purchase their own property. And so they bought a piece of property from the Indians, and they formed a colony and called it Providence, because of God's providence. And of course, we now know it as Providence, Rhode Island, where they purchased it and bought it. This is a monument. If you can see it, I may be in the way for most of you. But it says, the spring of clear, cold water located 30 feet west of this point led Roger Williams to found Providence here in the year 1636, from which the center of it was developed in four directions. And so there's a monument there giving him credit for that. It was the first place in America when he founded Providence. It was the first place in America to establish a separate church and state, proclaiming government without interference of religion and vice versa. The Providence Compact was the first American document that propagated the idea of government by consent of the governed and liberty of conscience. I don't know if I have the compact on there or not. Yeah, I do. Okay. The compact read this: "We, whose names are here underwritten, being desirous to inhabit in the town of Providence, do promise to submit ourselves in active and passive obedience to all such orders or agreements as shall be made for public good to the body in an orderly way, by the majority consent of the present inhabitants, masters of families incorporated together into a township, of such others whom they shall admit into the same only in civil things." The important phrase in that statement is that middle one that's underlined: by majority consent of the present inhabitants. This again was the first time where people had a say in how their government was to run and what was to take place. And this would result in the Rhode Island colony, which eventually, of course, became the state of Rhode Island, which would spread out until we had the state of Rhode Island, the first state to embrace religious freedom for all. And it started with Roger Williams when he established the Providence colony. Now, if this is what a real American is, then we can argue that Roger Williams was the first real American, light years ahead of anyone in his time. It'd be another 100 years or so before we begin to get any real moving of the founders in this same direction. It was wrote about this. It was wrote, let me go that way. Here we go. Arthur B. Strickland, writing the history of Roger Williams, he said this: "A government of the people, formed by the people, for the people, with church and state completely separate and with political privileges not dependent on religious belief, was organized and maintained successfully for the first time in Christendom in Rhode Island, the smallest of the American colonies. Its inspiration and founder was Roger Williams, the apostle of soul liberty, because he was the first asserter of the principle which has since been recognized as the distinctive character of our own national greatness. He can be called, or he has been called, the first American, because he embraced these principles of government by the people, for the people, by consent of the people, and separation of church and state, which is one of our primary tenets as Americans, isn't it? Or has been in the past, or it was in the past. There's a national monument or national park dedicated to Roger Williams, and you can kind of see his memorial there. If you can see it, if you ever want to go to Providence, Rhode Island, you can go check it out and see his memorial that's there. Again, this is from Roger Williams' National Memorial website. It says this: "Roger Williams National Memorial was established by Congress in 1965 to commemorate Williams' outstanding contributions to the developments of principles of freedom in this country. The memorial, a 4.5-acre urban green space located at the foot of College Hill in downtown Providence, includes a freshwater spring, which was at the center of the settlement of Providence Plantations founded by Williams in 1636. It's on this site that Williams, through word and action, fought for the ideal that religion must not be subject to the regulation of the state, but instead that it should be a matter of individual conscience. And it's a remarkable journey that brought Williams to what is now the capital of Rhode Island and to where he put his beliefs into practice, giving shelter for persons of distressed conscience." And so if you're ever up there, you can see it. It overlooks Providence, Rhode Island. We're almost done here. Most of Providence was burned in 1676, I believe it is when Providence was eventually burned. It was burned during what was referred to as King Philip's War, sometimes called the First Indian War. The First Indian War is considered the deadliest war in colonial American history. And as a result of that, many of the towns in New England were burned to the ground, and Providence was absolutely destroyed and burnt, and its economy was ruined. Roger Williams lost everything when Providence was burned. He died almost penniless, having lost everything that he had. And even though he was about 70 years of age by now, they appointed him the captain of the local militia. That's not on there, is it? Appointed him the captain of the local militia. And yet Roger Williams lived to see the town rebuild. He began to see it rebuilt. But shortly after the war ended, his wife Mary died. Him and Mary had 6 kids, and he saw his wife die shortly after that. And on May 6, 1862, Roger Williams wrote to Governor Bradstreet saying that he was old and weak and bruised with rupture and colic and lameness in both feet. His health was failing terribly. And less than a year after the letter, Roger Williams died. And exactly when is never recorded, but was sometime in early year of 1683, a small ceremony was held graveside. Freedom to believe as you wish. Is that on the slide? Yeah, freedom to believe as you wish. Liberty of conscience is at the heart of Roger Williams' legacy. Rhode Island was a refuge for people who were persecuted because of their religious belief. The colony became host of the first Baptist church in America. The oldest synagogue and the first Quaker meeting house in America were located in Rhode Island. Now, this was from the website, but he didn't establish the first church in America, as we're going to see, and that'll finish this up. But what's interesting about it is the Quakers were able to meet there. Rhode Island became a refuge for people to come and worship as they wanted to. Now, did Roger Williams agree with the Quakers? Did he agree with some of these other groups? No, he didn't. He didn't agree with them. He didn't believe what they believed. But he believed they had the freedom to come there and worship as they saw fit. And if that, again, if that's what an American is, then he certainly was the first American. Now, here's the question, and we'll end with this. Was Roger Williams a Baptist, and did he establish the first Baptist church in America? And we'll go home. The answer to that question is no and yes, depending on what you mean by was he a Baptist. You know, the beginning, some of this goes back to the beginning of the Baptist church at Providence. And if you read much Baptist history, there are books out there, complete books devoted to who established the first Baptist church in America. Was it Roger Williams or was it John Clark? And there's a big argument between those two. John Clark was the one who did it. He'll come a little later and we'll see him. But the question is, did Roger Williams establish the first Baptist church or did he establish the church? Well, here's what happened. After signing the Providence Compact, after they established the Providence colony and signed the Providence Compact, since they'd been excommunicated from the Church of England and they'd been excommunicated from the Congregational Church, and being separatists, they decided we need our own church. We need to establish our own church here in the colony. So the first thing that they did was establish a church. And the decision was made that the church was to be established on Baptist principles. They said, we need a Baptist church. That's what we need. And they called it a Baptist church. I think it was First Baptist Church of Providence, I think is what they refer to it as. Now, here's the problem, though. They only had infant baptism. That's all any of them had, was infant baptism. They'd been baptized in the Church of England, and so as a result of that, that's all they had. And so they didn't have scriptural immersion, as the scriptures teach, and so they all needed to be baptized. So what happened was, to rectify this, Ezekiel Holloman, which was one of the men of their company, was considered one of the more godly men of the company. To take care of this issue, he baptized Roger Williams, and then Roger Williams turned around and baptized everybody else. And then they established the First Baptist Church of Providence based on that. Now, if you know anything about Baptist doctrine, that's not scriptural, all right? It certainly isn't scriptural. There's no authority in that. There has to be authority involved in that. That certainly wasn't scriptural or in line with Baptist doctrine. You know, and he's credited by secular and some religious historians as the founder of the First Baptist Church of America. But while he embraced Baptist principles, there's no way doctrinally to say that this was an historic Baptist church because of the way it was established. Having said that, let me say this. That doesn't make it right. And while not making it right, before we're too hard on him, we need to think on their circumstances. You know, and Roger Williams is beat up by a lot of Baptist historians because they did this. But you've got to consider their circumstances. I was talking to a preacher the other day, and he said, you know, now that I'm getting older, he says, I find myself being more kinder and gentler than I was when in my 20s. Because the older you get, sometimes the more wise you get about people and things and the way things work out. And so you got to consider their circumstances and the situation that they were in. These were a group of people who had nothing but infant baptism. This was a great experiment. They're trying to figure their way out concerning things that we know. The only thing they had were Bibles. Was the Bible, that's all they had. They had no instruction on all this. They had no instruction on Baptist doctrine. They had Baptist principles, but they didn't really understand all of this. You know, for example, their background's an Anglican church, and the fact there was no Baptist church in America yet, where are you going to go? You couldn't call another Baptist preacher. You couldn't go visit another Baptist church. There weren't any. They had no references to go to except the scriptures. And you say, well, they had the Bible. Well, think about this for just a second. If I could erase everything you've ever been taught, if I could just blank it out of your mind and erase it out of your mind tonight, and you had nothing but a Bible, how many of you think that you would end up with just that Bible right where you are doctrinally with everything you believe right now? Chances are we never would we? Because all we'd have is our Bible, and we wouldn't have any background behind it. And so this is where they were. They had a Bible. That's what they had. Nothing wrong with that, but that's what they had. So now that doesn't make what they did right. But it does mean that I can understand their desire to try to do something that was right. And what's really interesting about this is that Roger Williams, several months after this, came to the conclusion that it wasn't right. And this is where I feel sorry for Brother Williams. I guess it was Brother Williams, for Roger Williams. This is where I begin to feel sorry for him And after he discovered from the scriptures, he continued to read his Bible, and he found out, so I guess it does prove you can figure it out, but he figured out this isn't right. He denounced it. And several months later, he denounced his baptism and concluded that the church at Providence was not scriptural, that there was nothing to do about it. So he just prayed. He wrote later on that he prayed that God would send an apostle, which was what they referred to as a preacher, that God would send an apostle or preacher to fix the problem and deal with it. And later on, the church at Providence, Rhode Island, was restructured and reinstituted. And so it eventually did straighten itself out. But Williams became what they refer to as a seeker. And this is where I feel sorry for him. He was a separatist. Historians say he was a separatist who could find no legitimate establishment to be a part of. So here's a man who has a burden to be biblically right, but doesn't know how to be biblically right. But he knows what's wrong, and he embraces Baptist principles, and he so wants to be right. But there's just nowhere to turn to or to go to figure this out. And he spends most of the rest of his life as a seeker. And I said, I can't agree with the way the Providence Church was established, but I appreciate William's burden for liberty and the soul of the native people. And I appreciate the fact that he did embrace Baptist principles, though I wouldn't dare say he was a strict Baptist. He certainly embraced our principles. And again, at the same time, as I said, I feel sorry for Williams. He was a man of strong convictions, even recognized in the error of his own baptism in denouncing it. And he was a man who wanted to do right by the scriptures, but the way he lacked the knowledge of how to go about doing it, which seemed to be a great burden on his soul when you read his writings and read his books. And there was no, you know, tonight, and I'm done with this statement, there are no perfect preachers. There are no perfect churches. There are no perfect men. We're all flawed. Come on, say amen to that. We're all flawed. We're not perfect. We don't make perfect decisions. We don't make perfect choices. We don't do everything perfect. We're just flawed people. As I said this morning, we ought to be thankful that God grants us the opportunity to serve him. A bunch of flawed, saved people that God lets us serve him. And sometimes we make mistakes. And sometimes our well-meaning intentions don't work out as we had thought they should. And Roger Williams was a flawed man, but he held the Baptist principles and longed to do right, though he lacked the perfect understanding of how to go about doing it. That doesn't make it right, but it means I certainly can feel for him. You know, we need more men. Listen, we need more men in modern Baptist history who have a desire to achieve something for God. Williams had a burden. He had a burden to reach the Indian people. He had a burden to see religious liberty, to want to be free, to serve God as he saw fit. We ought to be thankful that we're in a time where we can learn the scriptures. We can learn the truth. Isn't it amazing that Roger Williams longed for that? We live in a time when it's everywhere, and yet people are apathetic toward it. And we ought to desire to achieve something. I pray God give us men who would be willing, desiring to achieve something, to do something for God and be used of God. If God can use Roger Williams, he can use anybody. We're all flawed. God specializes in using flawed people. And so God can use people. And as I thought about this week, look in Hebrews 12, last verse. And we got to quit. I didn't realize we were as far over as we are. Hebrews 12. You've been very patient and awake we've gone as long as we have. The nursery workers, I'll have to slip past on the way out. But if I take off in a hurry, you'll know why. I'm trying to avoid the nursery people. Hebrews 12. It says this, "Wherefore, seeing we also are compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and sin that does so easily beset us, and let us run with patience the race that is set before us, looking unto Jesus, the author and the finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is set down on the right hand of the throne of God. For consider him that endured such contradiction of sinners against himself, lest ye be wearied and faint in your minds." He says, hang in there, serve God, and listen. The most important thing is that we run well and serve him. At the end of the day, it's all that matters, isn't it? Right. Is that we run well and serve him. And I'll leave you with this thought. We need people who have a burden or a desire to achieve something and do something for God. As I think about Baptist history, and I read a lot about it, and as I put things like this together for Roger Williams, I think about the stuff they did, the amazing stuff that they did, and how they're written. Now, Roger Williams, unfortunately, died in relative obscurity compared to the contribution that he made. But here's men who did great things. And I was thinking about this afternoon. You know, I was thinking, what have I done? You know, what will people remember about me? What will people remember that I've done? What will people remember that you've done? I mean, you think about the great things that have come. Now, God doesn't call all of us to be a Roger Williams. But the idea is we ought to have a hunger, desire to achieve something, to leave something behind for God. I don't want to leave a bad testimony behind. I don't want to leave that I quit behind. Amen. I don't believe that I gave up on God behind. I don't want to leave behind that I've messed everything up. I'd like to leave behind that I did something for Him. Even if it's the best Sunday school teacher I can be, or the best pastor I can be, or I started a church, or I raised godly family. I want to leave something behind. Don't you? Amen. I'd like to be remembered for something that matters and something that counts. And we ought to have that burden, that desire to achieve and do something for Him. Amen. I want you to stand with me if you will.